From absenteeism to flex arrangements and from elder care to self-care in the workplace. Today, Career Buzz goes to the 2013 Your Workplace Conference to bring you the best of the speakers on career and workplace topics that matter to you. This is Career Buzz Canada's unique radio conversation that empowers lives, enriches careers, and energizes organizations. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, practice leader of a team of professional career counselors at CareerCycles.com. Thanks for tuning in this morning. Today, we explore what makes a thriving workplace. Where is work-life balance to be found? What about a positive work culture? The costs, risks, and benefits associated with a healthy and engaged workforce was the focus of Your Workplace Conference for 2013, and I was pleased to be there as your Career Buzz correspondent to capture short interviews with 10 top speakers. First up, Professor Linda Duxbury. Linda is a professor at Carleton University. She gave the opening keynote at the conference. Linda's been studying workplaces for many years and is the researcher behind a significant piece of research of Canadians called Work Life and Caregiving Study. You can find out more about her work and area of study at Desjardins.com. Desjardins had sponsored part of the research, and there's a sort of executive summary on the Desjardins site called Balancing Work, Child Care, and Elder Care, A View from the Trenches. Here's my interview with Professor Linda Duxbury. We're at the 2013 Your Workplace Conference in Kingston, Ontario. My guest today is Linda Duxbury. She's professor at the Sprott School of Business at Carleton University. And I'm your host, Mark Franklin of Career Cycles. Linda, you introduced us to the 2012 Work Life and Caregiving Study. Mm-hmm. So what excites you about that study?
First, let me just put the study into context. I've been looking at the whole issue of work-life balance and stress for over 20 years. We did our first study in 91, where we had 33,000 Canadians participate. We did our second study in 2001, where we had 27,000. And in this case, this is our third look at it, the whole issue. And we had 25,000 Canadians geographically represented right across Canada's 71 companies. So what excites me is it kind of allows us to look, because we collect the same information over time from Canadians, and it kind of gives us a perspective on the issue. So what I think, I can't say excites, but what interests me is the fact that organizations in Canada have been talking about how important their people are and talking about balance for decades. But if you look objectively at the data, we see that, in fact, work-life conflict has gone up, stress has gone up, depressed mood has gone up, life satisfaction has gone down, commitment has gone down, job stress has gone up, absenteeism has gone up. And so, in other words, we hear the talk about valuing people, and we hear the talk about, you know, being one of Canada's best employers. But if we look at the data doesn't back up what a lot of employers are saying. Many of Canadians are still having real challenges.
Now, you talked particularly in the session this morning about elder care.
Yes.
And that's something that's new, and it seems like it was a really important finding from this year's, or the 2012 talk. Can you just tell us a little bit about why now? Why is elder care such an issue now?
So we deliberately actually focused on elder care because, I'm an academic. I look at statistics all the time. And if you look at statistics, you can see storm clouds on the horizon.
Yes.
So the storm clouds are, first of all, the last census that just came out showed that the only group in Canada that was increasing in size was, in fact, fragile elderly, over 85. Well, if you look, Canadians, because of medical science advances, people are living a lot longer. The life expectancy has gone up from 47 in the year 1900 to now 79 for men, 83 for women. At the same time, women are now firmly ensconced in Canada's workforce, and in fact, Canada and Canadian employers couldn't do without women in their workforce. So we don't have anybody at home looking after the elderly anymore. We have a healthcare system and governments whose policies are letting people age in the community, but that means that, in fact, for many of our employees, they're having to provide the supports that that they can't get from the community to help their parents age gracefully in the community.
In fact, you gave a number that was astonishing.
$6 billion worth of amount of time. Yes.
$6 billion worth of elder care services
people are providing if we were to value that service. Yeah, if we wanted to pay for the service that Canadian employees are giving their parents in terms of driving them here, picking up there, taking them to medical appointments, making them meals, doing grocery shopping, banking, just being there for them, you would in fact find the estimates are $6 billion a year. So that's a pretty big tax savings, but it comes at very high,
at a high cost.
Yes.
And high stress. So people have misconceptions about how long elder care takes. Maybe it's a sort of short thing, end of life, but your research shows different. How long do people care?
My research showed that on average, your caregiver, in my sample, because I was looking at employees, the average caregiver was 45, not an older person doing it at the end of life. And the average person was caring for two people, not one, and the average amount of time you spent in care was 6.5 years. And about 7 hours a week in terms of actual time caring for people. So that's where you get that $6 billion. That's a lot of activities, a lot of time. The other thing that was interesting for me is people choose whether or not to have children, but not parents. And so we had 1 in 3 women who were single and 1 in 4 men who were single also doing elder care. So it's not just married people who have this kind of responsibility.
You talked a bit about how we prioritize our time in life. We have work, we have parents, we have kids. It was very interesting to see the order of priority, where we put ourselves,
kind of
where we put... It was a little depressing, and I must say your talk was a little depressing, Linda.
But
it was an important piece.
Yeah.
How do we prioritize our time?
So people tend to give very high priority to work, because for many people, their career is important. For many, economic security is very important. And organizations have made it very clear, if you're not there for work, then you might not have work. People put a lot of time and give high priority to elder care, and that's because you can't buy a service to support you that doesn't exist. So they really have, it was very clear from the data, there's no one else to do it, there's no services to help me support my need to support my parents, so I have to do it. Children are third in line. People give a lot of time and attention to their children, then their partner, and finally, time to themselves. So, you know, as I said in the talk, that doesn't bode very well. It means that a lot of our employees today are highly stressed themselves and, you know, are likely to break down because of their priority set.
Very concerning stuff. So, in fact, what does the data say about the reasons why people take on the caregiving role?
The number one reason was they were closest physically. So, and that doesn't mean they lived in the same town, but they were the closest one of the family members, so the responsibility fell on them because they were of their position in the family. So oldest children, only daughters, only sons ended up having to do more because their siblings couldn't or weren't able to do it was a big one. Because there was no services, the person had no partner, so there was nobody else to do it. And it, way down on the list was because I owe it to them, because I love them and I owe it to them. So people do care about their parents and they do want to do it, but I think they would do less of it if they didn't feel that there was no choice.
Now, you just mentioned sons, and as a man in the audience, it was interesting to hear the changing role of men in elder care, and that has changed over the years that you've been doing this study. Can you say a little bit about men's roles?
Men used to have, we see changes in men, not just in elder care, but in child care too. Men who are 30 to 45 tend to be in the Gen X cohort. They had parents who were less involved in their upbringing and less there for them. And they tend to be quite close to their parents. So we see younger men are now spending more time in childcare, more time in elder care, and because of that, they're as stressed and have as many challenges balancing work and family as their female counterparts. So that is a real change. As I said at the beginning, it's being able to look at these things over time that is interesting and exciting. And we've really seen an increase in stress levels for men and an increased challenge for men in terms of balancing, a lot of it attached to elder care, and no real difference in women. They've been messed. Women have been messed up for decades.
My guest today is Linda Duxbury. She's professor at Carleton University. We're at the Your Workplace Conference, and I'm your host, Mark Franklin of Career Cycles. Let's just take a couple of minutes to talk about what employers, what they're dealing with, and what they can do. And you did mention a little bit about that in the talk. First of all, how has caregiving impacted organizations' bottom line?
So caregiving, probably even more in many ways than elder care, it's people with elder care are more likely to be absent from work, significantly more likely to be absent from work. They're more likely to reduce their work hours as a way of coping. Probably one of the biggest things for organizations to be aware of is that it's probably going to affect their succession planning, because a lot of people with elder care don't want to take on the added responsibility of management or promotion and are turning them down. They're more likely to reduce their work hours. They're more likely to use EAP and services. So all of these kinds of things are direct bottom line costs for the employer.
Productivity. Productivity is going to go down.
Productivity is going to go down. Absolutely, it's going to go down.
And that's what
even if they show up at work, even if they're there, if they're stressed and overwhelmed and feeling guilty and emotional, you know, it's bound to go down. Creativity is bound to go down too, because people don't, you know, don't have the energy to devote to creative solutions when they're overwhelmed by elder care.
Right on. So now this is hitting employers where it counts. And mm-hmm. so people are going to start paying attention, or hopefully
we hope they will.
You've been trying to get their attention for years. But when it comes to these kinds of drops in productivity, employers will ask, what can we do? And there's a host of solutions. You showed a few things. And some of the things that weren't as predictable or expected were the things that seemed to come up about what employers can do to provide recognition, I guess, for people who are in this situation. What are some of those
things? So the direct things that are seem to be, so I'll talk about two different things. One is the things that are particular to elder care. And that the first one we found was compressed work weeks. For childcare, it tends to be flex time, because people want to adjust their schedules to take children in, pick them up. But for elder care, people need to devote time during the 9-to-5 workday to take their parents to medical appointments, to go to the bank, all kinds of things that they need to do with or for their parents, they need to do at 9-to-5. The second is to give more emotional support and counseling specific for elder care. So expand your EAP offerings to offer grief counseling, because a lot of the dealing with elder care is dealing with grief as your parents age, and you realize that end of life is now. The third real thing is to facilitate support groups within the workplace, allowing people to talk to other people with caregiving, which offers them at the very least the ability to vent, but also gives them the ability to find out what other people have done and to see that they're not alone. In terms of work-life period, or your, you know, the whole thing on how to manage people more effectively,
yes,
focus on the immediate manager, because nobody works for an organization. They work for who they report to, which means you've got to give managers the time they need to manage people, not just operational responsibilities. You've got to give them the skills they need, and you've got to incent them to spend time and energy on managing people well, not just managing their bottom line type of things. The other thing is focus on culture. Culture is the unwritten rules and expectations. Our cultures are out of whack because we've operated for far too long with more good people than good jobs, and that allowed organizations to get sloppy, talk the talk but not walk the walk. So we have to start changing cultures to ones that actually recognize that hours at work is a bad metric of productivity, and that if we really and truly want engaged, creative, and innovative staff, then we have to actually allow them time and energy to have a life outside of work.
Tough thing to change. One of the aspects of organizational culture change that you did mention that caught my attention was increasing trust,
yes,
in the workplace. So
yes,
maybe we can just finish on that.
Well, any change requires trust, okay? I teach change. That's what I teach. And nobody's going to change just because the organization says so. Organization, people have to believe that, A, there's something in it for me. If I change, it's not just you that's going to benefit. And B, you're telling me the truth about what you're going to change and why you're going to change it, and see, you're going to follow through. You're not going to start this change initiative and then abandon it after I've spent time and energy and work and got my hopes up. And those three things are essential for successful change. Yet we know that particularly the 30 to 45-year-old group in the market, the Gen X, don't really have a lot of trust right now. And why would they? They haven't been treated well by employers for the last 15, 20 years. They've heard the talk, but they haven't actually experienced a lot of the walk. And so to move forward on this and to change the culture, which I think is absolutely necessary, you're going to have to build trust before you can change.
Fascinating to talk to you about this, Linda Duxbury. Thank you so much for joining
us here
today.
You're more than welcome.
And that was my interview with Professor Linda Duxbury. She's at Carleton University and was the keynote of the Your Workplace 2013 conference in June. You can find out more about Professor Duxbury at her faculty page, which is Sprott, S-P-R-O-T-T, .carleton.co. And the report she authored was sponsored in part by Desjardins, and you can follow the links to it at DesjardinsLifeInsurance.com, or you can search there. It's really worth a read. There was fascinating insights about what's going on in today's workplace, especially around this issue of elder care that she spoke about based on her research. You're listening to Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, here on 89.5 FM and CIUT.FM. So we're going through a few of the speakers at the Your Workplace 2013 conference, and next up is Heather Steenson. She works as a health and wellness senior specialist at Sun Life Financial. She focused her talk on workplace wellness and a fascinating concept of return on investment, wellness and return on investment, and bringing that to bear as a business strategy. So it's workplace wellness and connecting that to business strategy. Here's my interview with Heather Steenson.
We're at the 2013 Your Workplace Conference. My guest this afternoon is Heather Steenson from Sun Life Financial. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, from Career Cycles. Heather, what do you like about your job these days?
What I like about my job, honestly, is the opportunity to be one of the many players that has the opportunity to have a legitimate impact on the health of Canadians overall. It sounds, you know, a bit of a, you know, a lofty statement to make, but ultimately I do believe that, you know, one lifestyle change leads to one life change, leads to a family change, and ultimately impacts organizations and communities. And Sun Life covers a lot of people in Canada, so we've got direct access to really have impact.
That's great. And what is your job or job title? What are you called?
So I am currently the health and wellness senior specialist, and ultimately really what that means is that I'm telling a lot of not only just Sun Life's story as far as what our product offerings are, but telling the story of workplace wellness programs, why they're essential, and how they can ultimately have positive impact.
Right. So you were talking today at the conference about workplace wellness. What does that even mean?
So ultimately, a lot of people would define wellness in many different ways, and I'm one of the people that has a very broad definition of what wellness is, but workplace wellness specifically is really a business strategy within organizations where there are things that employers are doing with their direct access to plan members and to employees to have an impact on that employee's health and well-being, for the end goal of ultimately impacting their productivity and their direct line of impacting the overall corporate success. Mm.
So you've really put it in a business context that workplace wellness is a business strategy.
Correct.
So there seems to be many barriers. You talked a little bit about it today. Barriers to good health, barriers to workplace wellness. What are some of those barriers?
Well, we're really our own worst enemy in that space. So if we take a look at it on an individual level, which Sun Life does a lot of, we have a Canadian Health Index where we survey Canadians on their attitudes, perceptions, and beliefs. And the top three barriers are lack of willpower, lack of motivation, then followed by lack of time and lack of money. So these are, you know, understandable to a lot of individuals, but the great news with those messages is that employers are perfectly positioned to help individuals overcome those barriers.
So how do they overcome? How do employers foster better health? What are some strategies or approaches or techniques that you've seen be successful that employers can now implement?
So as far as lack of motivation or lack of willpower goes, really making things available within the workplace and really having a culture that supports a collaborative effort in leading healthy lifestyles. A lot of that can be through team initiatives, through awareness, through incentive programs. You know, it's sad to say, but human nature in general, if you dangle the carrot, and Canadians specifically, really respond. So incenting employees to become more aware of what their health is and what their health risks are, and then ultimately taking that next step of incenting and encouraging behaviors within that organization so that people are now doing targeted intervention on what their risks are to ultimately move the needle and, you know, not just take a look at the health of the organization in the light of what's happening today, who are the high, you know, users of benefit plans and off on LTD, but what's coming down the pipeline.
So you talked a little bit about the return on investment about wellness initiatives, and a lot of people might think, well, this is kind of nice stuff, but it doesn't have an impact. It's not worth the investment. Where do people start when considering the idea of return on investment of workplace wellness initiatives?
So what's happening currently, actually, and it's fairly young, is a wellness ROI Canadian study that's taking place, and it's really the first of its kind. It's a landmark study where Sun Life has a strategic alliance with the Richard Ivey School of Business to do an in-field study where we are putting through several organizations through a best-in-class wellness program with treatment and control groups in order to capture the impact of what that program is. So this is really one of the barriers that is still put up by many organizations as to the reasons why not to get into wellness. But aside from that, there are still so many that can build the business case in the absence of the ROI, because I think there'll still be some challenges after that. So really understanding how the engagement and productivity and health levels of each employee impacts the work that they do and how that feeds into the bottom line, because on an individual basis, we both know, you know, if we're fighting a bug, or if we're overweight, or if we've got, you know, burnout factor and excess stress, we know on an individual level how that impacts our daily productivity and ability to focus. So multiply that by the number of people in your organization. If you have a program that you know will impact 10% of the organization, do you really need that hard number? There's a lot of organizations that know that A, it's the right thing to do, and B, that ultimately, you know, you start to build that culture and you're clearing out the pipeline and building those benefits for tomorrow as well.
Mm. That study that you're talking about the return on investment sounds fascinating. Can listeners find out more about that? Is that published yet, or what's the, and if so, where can people find it?
Yeah, it actually is very public. One of our statements is that we're, you know, our mission and our vision is to really improve the health of Canada, one individual at a time. So we do very much have that Canadian focused as opposed to, you know, Sun Life members only. So the study and the findings are very public. So we do have a public domain. We've got a microsite, and it's sunlife.ca/wellness institute, and all of the information and findings are being presented on there, because the end goal of this study is to not have a university paper that's read by few and understood by even fewer, but to actually put tools and information, concrete information, into organizations' hands to help them build their own business case.
Great. Heather, last question. In your own career and life, you've had some twists and turns. We didn't hear too much about them, but you sound like you're quite happy doing what you're doing now. What can you share with listeners about making good career and life choices, even drawing on your own personal experience?
Well, I think, and this fits into my broad definition of what wellness is, within the organization, I think step one, the number one thing that people have to ensure, and I think individuals hold most of the accountability over the organization, is fit. Do you have a fit within your role? You know, does it fit not only your skill set, but the things that you believe? And so for me, I have to say that I do have absolute fit right now, not only in the line of business that I'm doing, but I'm very proud to wear the Sun Life pin and what they stand for and what they do. And I have to share with you that in the capacity of workplace wellness and this career that I've built for myself and that I hope to be in for quite some time now, what motivates me the most is not the changes that I've helped to implement, not the success rates of different programs that I've done both firsthand or with clients, but the successes that we'll never hear about, the things that won't happen to
people. The secret successes.
The secret successes. And what I mean by that is
you know, somebody who were able to help facilitate a lifestyle change that ultimately leads to a heart attack not happening or being pushed out 10 years. You know, the changes, I care very much about the success of organizations, but at my core, I hate to use this term, but I am a people person, and I care about the impact on individuals' lives and what that means they bring home to their family, which ultimately leads to communities and, you know, starts to spill over. So I'm motivated, you know, in the thought that I could be one of the players that impacts a heart attack never happening.
Right on. Heather Steenson, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and views in this interview.
Thank you very much.
That was my interview with Heather Steenson, Health and Wellness Senior Specialist at Sun Life Financial. You can find out more about the project and research that Heather was talking about at sunlife.ca. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, here on Career Buzz, CIUT 89.5 FM and worldwide at CIUT.FM. We're listening to interviews that I conducted a couple of weeks ago in June at the Your Workplace 2013 conference. We had 10 top speakers. We're listening to their interviews both today, and I'll play the balance of them on June 24th. After break, we will have three or four more interviews. I also want to let listeners know, last week we had Barbara Moses here. Many of you will recognize the name. She's written books like What's Next and was a Globe and Mail columnist on career and workplace issues. And I have a book giveaway. So one of her books, What Next, she generously provided. And I have one more book giveaway. Would love to hear from you. I'll give out the phone numbers after the musical break. And you can call in with a comment or a question, and you can win a copy of Barbara Moses's book, What Next. So when you're wanting to feel good in the workplace, what might you do? Well, here's a song that says, When I Sing, and you'll hear how that sounds. It's the soundtrack from Bye Bye Blues, sung by Rebecca Jenkins.
Well, it's easy to be blue. It's easy to be sad. It's easy to be broken-hearted. I don't know about you, but when I'm feeling bad, there's nothing like a song to get me started. 'Cause when I sing, I feel as light as spring. It's a funny thing. I just feel a lot better when I sing. I start to swing. It's a funny thing.
This hour is brought to you by the Mariposa Folk Festival, July 5th to 7th, featuring 100-plus performances on 9 stages, including Randy Bachman and Mercedes, Arlo Guthrie, Kathleen Edwards, and more. Tudhoe Park, Orillia, 90 minutes north of Toronto. Visit MariposaFolk.com.
You've seen us on the streets, in the subway, on the news. Now's your chance to catch Toronto's red-hot Balkan Klezmer Gypsy Party Funk Superband, the Lemon Bucket Orchestra, on the big stage. Friday, July 5th at the Opera House, Lemon Bucket will join forces with our heroes from Romania, the electrifying Fanfare Ciocarlia, an explosive double bill that will surely have the city dancing in the streets. Buy your tickets now, lemonbucket.com. Presented in part by CIUT 89.5 FM.
The evolution continues. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
And we're back at Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, practice leader of a team of professional career counselors at careercycles.com. Before continuing on with the Your Workplace interviews on today's show, I want to let you know about the archive of Career Buzz inspiring career stories. So we've had hundreds of guests on the show, and we've archived the shows at the Career Buzz button at careercycles.com. If you go to the last show, just last week on June 26th, in case you missed it, we had three guests, in fact. We had two guests from TED Talk. So, you know, those inspiring 18-minute talks. We had Emma Brooks, who is the program director for TEDx Toronto, and told us what it takes to actually get in to be a TED Talk. It was fascinating hearing about that, how many applicants they get for the 18 or 20 spots that they actually have. We also spoke to Drew Dudley. His TED Talk was viewed by a million people, and he talks about what that was like, just going onto stage, prior to going onto stage, how he felt, knowing that this was going to be, you know, for posterity, and it was videotaped, and how his career really changed after he did his TED Talk. We also had columnist and author Barbara Moses. She was talking to us about many contemporary workplace issues along the lines of what you're hearing today from the Your Workplace interviews. She also offered a couple of books. We have one of her books, What's Next? Thank you, Barbara, for making that available. If listeners have a comment or question today, please give us a call, and the number to call for that book is 416-946-7000, 416-946-7000. And you can give us a call. Christina is there waiting for your call. And give us a call if you want to win that book, What's Next? Managing Your Career by Barbara Moses. So we are continuing on with our workplace, Your Workplace interviews. Next up is Katarina Sanders. She's Vice President of Habanero Consulting. She spoke at the Your Workplace conference on flex arrangements. So workplaces that offer flexibility in terms of days of the week or hours of the day. Her topic brought into focus the gains that organizations can make in employee engagement and well-being when they implement flex arrangements for their employees. Here's my interview with Katarina Sanders.
We're at the Your Workplace Conference. My guest today is Katarina Sanders of Habanero Consulting, and I'm your host, Mark Franklin. Katarina, what do you like about your career these days?
I get a huge amount of variety in everything that I do. No day is ever the same. I also am hugely fortunate to have been with the same organization now for almost 12 years, and I'm surrounded by people who I would consider some of my best friends as well as workmates.
And what do you do there at Habanero Consulting?
So I'm the vice president, and so what that means is that I look after anything to do with employee experience as well as day-to-day operations.
So today we heard you talk a little bit about flex arrangements in the workplace. Fascinating topic, Katarina. Can you help us out? What do you mean when you say flex arrangements? What does that even mean?
I mean, sort of the nuts and bolts is stuff that we're all getting more and more familiar with. So things like compressed work weeks, the ability to work from home, being able to start and end your day as you see fit. That's kind of what flex arrangements are from the kind of ground floor view. But really what it's talking about is allowing employees the ability to figure out the best way to get done what they need to get done. And once they've figured out how to do something, that to just let them do it, as opposed to the more traditional, you clock in, you punch out, somebody sort of standing over you trying to see what have you done today and is it good enough and is it what we needed done.
So there's lots of benefits of flex arrangements from an employee's point of view. What are a couple of the benefits of flex arrangements from the employer's point of view?
Well, I mean, probably the things you'll hear the most for employers is it's a great recruitment and retention tool. People have an expectation now, and I think a justifiable one, that their work needs to fit into their life as opposed to their life fitting into their work. And so being an organization that can do flex arrangements so that someone, you hear it a lot from people who have young families. So it's the classic example of, I'd really love to be able to pick my son up after school, or I need to be able to leave from time to time so that I can take, the soccer practice or piano recital or whatever the case may be. But it's not just people with families. It's just individuals who like to sleep in or who find that they're most productive at 1 a.m., which, you know, dragging yourself into work at 1 a.m. is not really all that appealing.
Right on. Now, there's lots of considerations to take into account when implementing flex arrangements. You talked about a number of them in your presentation. One that caught my attention was organizational culture.
Mm-hmm.
So what do people need to be aware of when thinking about their culture and how that might or might not dovetail with flex arrangements?
Absolutely. I think the number one thing that they need to be aware of is that they need a culture where they have the right people hired who they are confident understand what is expected of them, and that their culture is one where individuals already can act with autonomy and have a control over their day-to-day. So if they're doing that in the office, there really isn't any reason that they can't be just as successful doing that outside of the office from a cultural perspective. I mean, there's also things like, what are the predominant leadership styles? If it's kind of a command and control sort of a culture, you might not have the most success with your flex arrangements because people aren't used to having that level of autonomy or being kind of held responsible for their actions.
So there's a number of other possibilities and interventions you mentioned. You took us on a detour in the presentation, which I thought was a great piece of, great way to include a kind of alternative thoughts in a presentation. One of them was about performance managers, and you talked to us a little bit about a performance manager and how that might support a culture that has flex arrangements in it.
Mm-hmm.
What's a performance manager?
Well, by our definition, a performance manager is not a boss. They're not someone who's just there to kind of crack the whip or even not have a relationship with you. You know, they're not this person that you might get performance feedback once a year if you're lucky. For us, a performance manager plays the role of a coach. And why they're so powerful when you're talking about something. Why a performance manager like that would be so powerful when you're talking about flex arrangements is these are people who really understand you, who you are, your strengths, what motivates you, you know, when you're fired up, when you're working at your best. And they also understand the work that you're trying to do inside of the greater context of the organization. So they're someone that you can really lean on and work with in order to have the deepest understanding of what you're meant to be doing, how you can do it most successfully, so that you see your career blossom. But it's all done from a place of internal motivation for yourself, which is kind of the best place you want anything to come from.
It sounds a bit like mentoring, the way you're describing it. How is it different or the same as mentoring?
That is a much more succinct way of saying what I just said. Yes, absolutely. Mentor or coach, for sure, is the model.
Great. Let me just come back to the personal and your own story, Katerina, from the twists and turns that you've had and now the tenure you've had at Habanero. What can you share with listeners about making good career and life choices that you've learned from your own experience?
I do believe coming from a place of personal insight will always give you an anchor from which to make your decisions and your behaviors. So it's not that I sit around and navel gaze and figure out who am I and what was I put on this earth to do, but having some interest and curiosity into when you feel happiest and what really floats your boat is a fantastic foundation from which to then move forward. I think it gives you the ability to take some chances and head into some kind of interesting directions that you might not do if you weren't somewhat grounded in who you are and what you're looking for.
Great advice. Katerina Sanders, thanks so much for joining us here in the interview.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
That was my interview with Katerina Sanders, Habanero Consulting, from the Your Workplace 2013 conference. You can find out more about Katerina and her company at habaneroconsulting.com. You're listening to Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, here on CIUT 89.5 FM and CIUT.FM worldwide. We did have a caller with a comment or a question who won the book. John, are you there?
I am, yeah.
Great. What was your comment or question about what we're hearing today on the radio?
Well, I'm ripe for wanting flex time. I'm wondering about a strategy to approach my employer about instituting a flex time program.
Yeah, there was that last interview with Katarina. She was talking about flex time and all of the advantages that that companies gain from implementing it. So she mentioned a few of those, and I think the perspective in speaking to employers is to talk about the advantages because they're not readily apparent, and I think it concerns managers
right.
that they might lose control. What is it that you want out of a flex arrangement?
I find the commute into the office and just our office environment, which is I don't get as much work done as if I could spend that commute time at home or even in a coffee shop. I end up getting more work done. At the office, it seems to be a lot more social interaction, which is great, but I don't find I'm getting the productivity.
Right on. Well, there's an argument in your favor is that you're going to be way more productive and you're going to waste less time if you have some flexibility in your time shifting really is what you're talking about.
Right.
Right on. So, you know, I encourage you to check that out. Find out more. I think Katarina's presentation is on is either on her site or the yourworkplace.ca site, and you can find
Perfect.
Out a few of her suggestions. But thanks for calling in and congratulations on winning the book.
Great. Thanks very much.
Great. If you have a comment or question about what you're hearing, give us a call. I've got another interview coming up for a few minutes, and then we'll have another break. So I want to introduce this next interview with Maria Vandenherk and Carola Moore of Banyan Work Health Solutions. They were talking about absenteeism. So, you know, if people don't have flex time and other engaging things to do, there's a lot of absenteeism. She said an astounding 77% of employees miss over 8 days of work a year. So they spoke at the Your Workplace conference on that topic, why people miss work and what organizations are doing to address absenteeism. Here's Maria Vandenherk and Carola Moore, interviewed by guest host Karen Richardson.
We're at the 2013 Your Workplace conference. We have an interview with Maria Vandenherk and Carola Moore of Banyan Work Health Solutions. And your host for this interview is Karen Richardson.
So an astounding 77% of employees miss 8 days of work a year for a variety of reasons. Maria, do you want to comment on some statistics in Canada about workplace absenteeism?
Yeah, workplace absenteeism is a significant cost to employers across Canada. It amounts to $7.4 billion a year in total. And if you start adding in the cost of STD and LTD, you're upping that to about $1,700 per employee per year. So it's a staggering cost, and it's not on the decline. It's actually on the increase. We see absenteeism costs rising across the country in many, many companies.
Some of the strategies you talked about today at the Your Workplace conference have been very progressive in terms of acknowledging management by outcome, not time management, and not necessarily looking at hours that employees are clocking. Did you want to? One of you want to elaborate on that?
I think Carola is probably the best to speak to some of the strategies that have to do with the bedrock of companies, things that are more innovative, things that reflect an inspired organization.
So we spoke about four strategies today, and the outcomes-based management was certainly one of those. And we challenged the assumptions around absence management and wanted to get people thinking beyond reacting and towards building inspired organizations where absence is no longer the issue it is now, and being attendance and being present is the norm. And so one of those strategies certainly is a management by outcome. What that does is it speaks to people's need to be autonomous, to exercise some sort of control over their own work. And what we have found is giving people very clear goals and very clear outcomes allows them to shine in how they achieve those outcomes in spite of the time that they may or may not be spending on those particular projects.
Can you talk about the role that technology can play in terms of increasing workplace morale and trust and perhaps decreasing the overall rate of absenteeism?
Technology is like a critical success factor. We've embraced technology early in our own company, and we're a virtual company, so it goes with the method. But I think there's sort of two fronts on technology. One has to do with all the amazing ways it has, that it brings in terms of building engagement, better communication, opportunities to have fun with your people, all sorts of two-way, back-and-forth transparency and involvement with each other. And on another front, it also brings you to a much higher level of accountability. All of a sudden, you have insight into work in flow, work in progress. You can see what's going on. It creates a completely different platform communication for communications around what is happening while it's happening. So to me, technology is paramount, and it goes with the desire for flexibility. You want the flexibility. We have to do it within some sort of environment, and technology is the house.
Can you talk about some of the other strategies that managers can use? They face this challenging task of trying to measure absenteeism and how to deal with that. Are there some other strategies they can take in the workplace today?
So I think we spoke about very briefly some of the current practices and some of the traditional practices, and I think we'd be remiss to not mention them and talk about health and safety and wellness and mental health, psychological health in the workplace. But what we're really trying to talk about is the Inspired Organization, which is an entirely different management and organizational culture. And so we absolutely hold a fundamental belief that people need to be engaged and motivated and happy at work. And clearly that requires the manager to understand what are those factors driving engagement. The manager is also a key communicator. The manager connects various pieces of the organization, various levels, various stakeholders, various players inside and out. And so open, clear, consistent communication creates that psychological proximity where people again feel they belong, they're connected, they know what's going on, they're connected to something bigger than just themselves. That drives engagement and it drives down absenteeism.
The evolution continues. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
You're listening to Career Buzz. That was guest host Karen Richardson interviewing Maria Vandenherk and Carola Moore of Banyan Work Health Solutions. You can find out more about them at banyanconsultants.com. We're taking a tour through the speakers at the Your Workplace 2013 conference. It was held in Kingston, Ontario. And next up, stress, depression, marginal life satisfaction. These are the mental health issues that are affecting employees and employers alike right across Canada. Laura Pratt is National Practice Leader of Organizational Health with Great West Life Assurance Company. She spoke at the Your Workplace Conference on mental health and what organizations can do to support better mental health in the workplace. Again, here is guest host Karen Richardson interviewing Laura Pratt of Great West Life Assurance Company.
We're at the 2013 Your Workplace Conference in Kingston, Ontario. We have an interview coming up with Laura Pratt of Great West Life. Your interviewer for this segment is Karen Richardson, and I'm Mark Franklin of Career Cycles.
I'm Laura Pratt. I work with Great West Life, and I'm very pleased to promote a resource that we make available to Canadian employers through our Great West Life Center for Mental Health. Laura, today at the Your Workplace Conference, you talked about how mental health is a huge issue for Canadian organizations today. Can you talk about why Great West Life is making this resource of your website available to workplaces?
I think as a large employer in Canada and as a benefits provider working with other employers across Canada, we see the impact of mental health every day in the cost of the benefit program and in absence trends. So we really felt that this was a good place to focus, and back in 2006 we began the development of the site, which we launched to Canadian employers in 2007.
What can organizations do to equip managers to help to engage with employees in a healthy way?
Well, one of the things that organizations have been looking at lately is with the launch of the National Standard for Psychological Health and Safety in the Workplace is equipping managers to engage with their employees in a mentally healthy way. And so we developed and launched Managing Mental Health Matters, which is a tool in the Center for Mental Health, which allows managers to skill up, to build skills, to engage with their employees, to respond appropriately and positively to various scenarios they may face in the workplace.
Can you describe one or two of the tools that are available to employers to deal with mental health in the workplace?
In the Center for Mental Health, it's a virtual center, so it's a website where employers can access knowledge and research in the area of mental health, but also turn that knowledge into action. So that means using resources to develop skills, as I just said, with the Managing Mental Health Matters material. There's also a resource called Working Through It, which is an excellent resource for employees to access to see videotaped interviews with people who have struggled with mental health concerns, who have come through that struggle successfully and can offer their own experiences in that area and give people hope that there's actually a light at the end of the tunnel and a way to move through that process with a positive outcome.
And can these real-life experiences help with different cases of mental illness in the workplace, say if there's a mild issue, or just to help managers assess the different levels of mental illness in the workplace?
And I think one thing that is always a concern is the perception that managers are being asked to assess or to even diagnose the fact that there's a mental health issue. And what this site is trying to do is give people the tools and the resources to foster a mentally healthy environment and to allow people to get access to support when they need it. Managers don't need to identify mental health necessarily, but they may observe behaviors that are problematic in the workplace, and they may have, as a result, they will have access to resources and education that will help them deal with those behaviors and ensure that their employees get access to the right help.
Can you talk about your approach for returning to work, some of the steps that managers can take in terms of keeping employees engaged throughout that process?
There is, in the website, there's an excellent return to work section which allows organizations to work through a strategy around successful return to work. And I think the most positive step that they can take right up front is engaging the people who are involved in the return to work process to sit down and look at what does this return to work process actually look like? What is our role internally? What's the role of the employee's manager? What's the role of the carrier if that person happens to be off on disability? That disability case manager or the rehab consultant play a key role. Let's make sure that we all understand what that process is going to look like, that we understand each other's roles, that there aren't any gaps in the process, that we're not overlapping each other. And if you start off on that foot, then you can be, you have a better chance of being successful. The other piece of it would be making sure that there is engagement with that absent worker, with that person who's off on let's say, a longer-term disability, all the way through their absence, so that they continue to feel somewhat engaged to the workplace or engaged with the workplace. If the first connection that they have with the workplace after an extended absence is at the return-to-work point, then the risk of that return-to-work being unsuccessful is much greater.
And is there a role for interaction in post-return to work, so after the employee has returned?
Yeah. And I think, all the way through the return-to-work process, because often it's a graduated process. It's not you're off one day, you're back full-time the next. There's a graduated reintegration into the workplace. And then, ensuring that that person knows where to go to get help, or the manager is equipped to recognize if that person is struggling in any way so that we can positively address those concerns as opposed to just allowing it to escalate again into yet another absence.
Thank you much. Thank you very much, Laura, for addressing these issues.
Thank you.
That was guest host Karen Richardson interviewing Laura Pratt of Great West Life Assurance Company. Check workplacestrategiesformentalhealth.com. That's workplacestrategiesformentalhealth.com. You're listening to Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, here on CIUT 89.5 FM. You've been listening to the inspiring speakers at the Your Workplace Conference from June 2013. Who spearheaded the Your Workplace Conference? It was Vera Asinin and her team. She is my next guest. She's president and publisher of Your Workplace magazine. Vera and her team pulled together an exciting 2013 conference, now in its 15th year. At the end of day one of the conference, delegates and speakers boarded a ship for a cruise to the Thousand Islands. It was a lovely day with views of Kingston and Wolf Island and the Thousand Islands. That's where I caught up with Vera Asinin.
We're at the Your Workplace Conference, and I'm speaking to Vera Asinin, president and publisher of Your Workplace, and I'm your host, Mark Franklin of Career Cycles. Vera, it's been a great first day of the conference. It's your 15th anniversary. What does that mean to you?
Wow. It's exciting. It means, in one word, it means community. community because for 15 years we've had people who believe in what we do. We have people who believe in healthy workplaces, in creating opportunities for people to soar in their career. And that's really exciting.
Now, we heard from a lot of amazing speakers today. It was such a privilege to hear many of the speakers, but I was especially impressed with the anchor keynote this morning, Linda Duxbury. Why did you want to have Linda as part of the conference, especially to kick it off?
I think that there's a lot of events. There's a lot of content available for everybody all the time. And we can choose what content we choose to hear. And so when I structured the conference, I wanted to start off with research, with real, tangible findings of what expressing the voices of Canadians in this case. And she spoke to 25,000 Canadians. And who can deny that voice? And so I wanted to start with her to say, what are the findings from the research she conducted? And from there, let's talk about solutions that we can come up with to solve some of those concerns that came out from that.
Awesome. Well, I had a great interview with her. And the rest of this conference is a real learning adventure. Now, those were your words. You wrote this nice little introductory remark, I guess, in the program. And you called this a learning adventure. What does that mean?
Because the thing is, there are times, and I really believe that we need to put effort out in the direction in which we want to go. And we put all of our energy into that direction. And then there's a time where you have to let go. Let go and allow everything else to come into play. And coming into play means other people coming to the table to assist you in what you want to do. And so the adventure part is, I wasn't sure how it was going to unfold today, but what I knew is that I brought some of the best people together. I invited people to attend, but through their registrations. And then the adventure is coming together to see what's going to happen and what the learning opportunity is. And it's been absolutely profound.
I love it. I love that little phrase there. Now, you know, the magazine and the conference talks about thriving workplaces that lead to outstanding results. So this linkage, thriving workplaces, a lot of discussion today was about engagement and thriving and flourishing. But then again, organizations need results. And if they're going to invest in some of these initiatives, they need to see what those results are. So in your mind, what is the link between thriving workplaces and outstanding results?
May I be cliche?
Shoot.
Well, you know what? You look at a garden, right? And you look at a basic garden where you the quality of the soil you have, you put seeds in, you feed it, you tend to it, you put sun on it, and it grows. And you get results. And that's what I'm talking about. In the simplest terms, when you have an environment where people can grow and thrive, where people can soar to their greatest potential, where you provide them the resources like the sun, and you provide resources like the tools to allow them to be their best, they're going to produce. And you know what they do? Cliche or not, there's an analogy between those two environments. And I think that the more that we go through this journey of making organizations aware that it's not about policy and procedures, it's about the environment they create to allow people to be their best, because that's what they want to be. They want to be their best. That's when we're going to hit goldmine.
Right on. And when the conference is over and people are leaving, what do you want to have them have in their mind and in their hearts about what they experienced here?
I want them to feel like they're not alone. All too often in the work that we do, we feel like we're alone. We feel that this is the burden that we bear. It feels that there's always an endless amount of work to do. But here, it's understanding that there are others in the same place, that it is about community. Others are going through the same experience, and they're walking away having met other people, having solutions to some of the issues in their work, but they're feeling good. And you know, when you feel good, you can be your best. You really can. And that's what I think is the most important thing is fueling that so people will be their optimum. And what they don't know yet, Mark, is that once a month, I'm going to be sending them content in audio form, in a video form, through articles to remind them of what they learned, to remind them of the experience that they've just had.
Right on. Congratulations, Vera, on a job well done, on your 15th anniversary, and thanks for this interview.
And you know what, Mark? Thank you for doing the work that you do, because it's very important.
Pleasure.
That was my interview with Vera Asadin, president and publisher of Your Workplace magazine. Thanks, Vera, for inviting me out there. It was a wonderful conference. Check yourworkplace.ca to find out more about the conference and the magazine. And I'd like to wrap up today's show by thanking all of the guests today. We had Linda Duxbury, Heather Steenson, Katarina Sanders, Maria Vandenher, Carola Moore, Laura Pratt, Vera Asadin, technical production